This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Don't miss the new docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History. From memes to movements, see how this powerful online community shapes culture and society. Black Twitter, A People's History is now streaming on Hulu.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. It's Bullseye. If you listen to Bullseye for a while, you know this already, but every guest that we have on our show has made work that I personally care about and admire. Sometimes you've heard of them already, sometimes you haven't. I'm guessing that my next guest probably falls into the latter category. So, hear me out. He's a guy from New Zealand. His name is Tom Scott. He's in his 30s, lives in Auckland. He has a kid. He's been working in hip-hop for about a decade. He's one of the most important figures in New Zealand hip-hop, but financially that doesn't mean a ton. Last year, he put out an album under the name Avondale Bowling Club. And it was, to be honest, stunning. It's a hip-hop record with jazz instrumentation. Real jazz, not just 4- and 8-bar loops of jazz records. Pushing forward in the territory that Kendrick Lamar staked out with To Pimp a Butterfly. It's also an incredibly personal album. He named it after the suburb of Auckland where he grew up. It's where he lives now, too. Scott raps about his childhood, the places he's been, the people he doesn't see anymore, his family. It's one of my favorite records of the last year. I think you'll really like it, too. Let's take a listen to a song off of Avondale Bowling Club. This one is called Old Dogs.
Yeah, one of them days. And we were chilling at the park, feeling like a Miller at the Ark. Killing it like Starks at the Garden. Feeling myself, my self-esteem can't be guarded. Been on my calm in San Diego. Just got back from France and I got a little bit of that Parisian steez in me still. My knees are Grand Hill, but I still feel like Phil. I'm on that Zenting. Feel like I just won my 10th ring. I'm on. I could shoot the sun into a wedding ring from half quarters pouring shots falling like...
Tom Scott, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, bruv.
I
appreciate it.
I was thinking that this record feels like it is kind of about growing up, and you're well into your 30s at this point. Were you not a grown up before?
I'm not a grown up as is. yeah, I'm still growing. I felt like there was some kind of, you have to take checkpoints, you know? Someone tweeted the other day, every time you look in the mirror is a checkpoint. So that was pretty buzzy. But yeah, I think sometimes at the completion of an album is kind of like that. It's like a checkpoint to see where you are. You start to realize what's changed between records and yeah, see how much you've matured from the last time. And I like to tell myself that I'm still maturing and going somewhere, so yeah.
Hip-hop isn't always the medium for maturing, and I say that as like a pretty serious hip-hop
no,
fan.
But fair enough, it hasn't really had, you know, it's still... only 40 years old, you know, that's a young art form, and there's not really a template for how to do it. Jay-Z's kind of showing us some way to do it, but it's pretty easy to be a cool, mature rapper when you're a multi-millionaire. But try to tell your friends you're a 34-year-old rapper when you got my income.
As a guy in my 30s myself, I feel like I really related to that song, Old Dogs, not because I can still, you know, knock down trays on the basketball court, which I absolutely cannot.
Me neither. but it's about belief, you know? You have to tell, you can't shoot to miss, my bro told me the other day. He's a professional. He said, you can't shoot to miss, because especially in our country, we got this humility that, you know, we got to keep it humble in New Zealand. We're at the bottom of the world, da da da. But we often just shoot, like, as long as it hits the ring, I won't look stupid, you know? But I think you got to be willing to airball. That's what he was trying to tell me. I don't know if that's a metaphor, but that's where the cockiness in that verse comes from. It's like telling yourself, like, you got this. You got this. And I think you learn more about how to shoot. You learn more about, you know, I can't beat some of these kids off the dribble anymore, but I can see the court a bit clearer. I think. At least I tell myself that to keep the shoes on.
Do you get that feeling when you're writing or on the microphone?
Yeah, definitely. It's funny, you start to master your craft by the time you're relevant, especially as a rapper. Maybe not so much as a jazz bassist or something. But yeah, it's definitely like that. And then trying to find a place where what you have to say should be heard is a weird one as a 34-year-old.
Can you tell me a little bit about what the hip-hop scene is like in New Zealand? New Zealand is a small country. I mean, I looked it up, and fewer people live in New Zealand than live here in Los Angeles.
Yeah. I'd like to say it's a bunch of dispossessed people, a lot of people that relate to the art form for the reason it was created, a lot of people that have things to say about the state of politics, whether they deliberately say those things or not. They have those things that they need to say, and they gravitate towards this art form because there's more freedom to speak on those things. It's almost encouraged, I guess. Yeah, people from working class neighborhoods, the majority of those people being Polynesian people. It came to New Zealand from a Samoan dude called Sugar Pop, I believe, who came from California, visited California, came down, started popping. And yeah, I mean, the hip hop scene's like anywhere else in the world. It's a little scene of people that get together. Yeah, these days, I guess it's getting more and more popular. It's pretty hard to speak about. It's like dancing about architecture. But yeah, that's my best description.
Is it a job? I mean, can you tour in New Zealand and make a living?
Nope. You can, like, I mean, I'm just in the studio at the moment with the bro that I just met, and we were just talking about what it is to be a musician and all the other side hustles that you have to have as a musician in New Zealand. And the bro does, you know, he records a bunch of adverts and things like that, and then when the doors are shut, he makes his own stuff. And I think that's what a lot of us do. You know, we wash dishes, we paint houses, we play in bands we might not really love, things like that. But that's how we're all getting through this world. I think we're all compromising our integrity throughout the day to keep the landlord fat.
I want to play a little bit of Pocket Lint from your album Avondale Bowling Club.
Sure.
My lady lay like the rent I'm spending. Every cent that I made, I spent. Cut the check and I paid my pen. Now all I got is this pocket lint. Bank to run the world ain't my friend. Man that owned the land ain't my kin. Fingers crossed at the ATM. All I got is this pocket lint. Pocket lint.
Avondale is a real place. Can you tell me about it?
Avondale. I'm from a place called Avondale. Yeah. Tell you about that. I just spent a whole album telling you about that. It's a working class neighborhood. It's the most diverse neighborhood in the country, other than a place called Porirua. So it's full of Polynesian people, Maori people, Indian people, Chinese, Nigerian, and it's one of the last places in Auckland to still not be gentrified. In fact, the gentrification even just jumped over Avondale and went to New Lynn. Like, we'll come back here. So it's a place that we're still fighting for, because I believe it's like, it's a template for utopia. It's not utopia, but it's some kind of like blueprint for it. Because you're all, I don't know, I'm going to get into some We Are the World if I'm not careful here, but yeah, it's a beautiful place, and it's something I believe in. It's one of the only things I believe in, to be honest. So I stand proud for it, and I've always tried to put it on the map and speak about it. It's my home. It's the place that I associate with as home.
You left and came back, right?
Yeah, I went to Melbourne. Just because in New Zealand there's only so much you can do before you've outgrown the fishbowl. Not that it's a beautiful fishbowl. I like the fishbowl. But, yeah, had to jump. So I went to Melbourne, went looking for something over there, and it was a little bit harder than I'd expected. I was really growing into the city, and then my girlfriend got pregnant. My fault. She didn't just get pregnant. I impregnated her. And then we came home. Yeah. That's about the story there.
Why did you decide to come home?
We came home because I wanted my son to be from here. I don't want to sound like a nationalist or anything like that, but I just wanted my son to be raised in this place because I value everything about this place. And I just didn't think he'd get those opportunities in Australia, as much as the money was better in Australia and the fishbowl was bigger in Australia. There's just something about New Zealand, about Aotearoa, that's just, yeah, I realized I valued it once I left it.
When I think of the place I grew up, there are like particular spots that hold a lot of meaning for me.
Yes, bruv. Yeah.
And I wonder what those spots are for you with Avondale.
I know exactly what those spots are for me. It's funny, like, it's the same spots you ran to when your mom sent you to your room, you know? The same spot you jumped out the window and went to. And for me, it's this one, it's the end of Avondale Road. There's a creek there. And I went there when I was a kid and we climbed the pylons. I went there when I was a teenager and we smoked weed. And I still go there as an adult when I'm anxious. I still just go there. It's a old creek that you wouldn't want to swim in. But we did as kids. And yeah, it's still that place. And it's still that same basketball court that I went to as a kid. Yeah, I think maybe like we were saying, it's those spots that are familiar. And they're just so rich in data, you know? And data of memories, you know? Like, yeah, they're just so rich. So they just seem so lit up. Something about those places, yeah. I'm probably under no illusion that some of these things are constructs of my mind. I'm like under no illusion that when I speak of home, it's probably not a physical place. But maybe it's just that, you know, I can sit there and see this sort of augmented reality of the past. You know, I can like lay it over this creek, the kids that we were playing in it. Lay it over this creek, you know, the teenagers that we were sitting there with a box of beers. It's really just a template. It's really just a background for memories, you know, to put layer memories on. So even if eventually there's a big sweatshop built on top of that creek, I can probably still see under it. So I still value those physical places for some reason, you know. But yeah, they change. But I just don't think... I mean, they're just such a great way to generate memories. When you go to those places, it just sparks memories. So I value those places. And yeah, I'm aware they change. But also, I think gentrification kind of teaches you what's important. There's a saying, a Māori saying, that goes, he tangata, he tangata, he tangata. And that just means the people, the people, the people. Yeah, the Māori have a saying, tangata whenua, that means the people of the land. And so when I'm glamorizing and romanticizing this land, this, you know, this place, it's really not about the land, it's about the people. And I think that's what I've learned through the gentrification of our neighborhood. If they push us out, I'll just follow the people, you know? I'll follow the nomadic people to wherever they push us. And I won't be too concerned that they want that piece of land because it's just a piece of land. Yeah.
Let's hear Avondale Bowling Club and Home.
On the plane, rain dripping on the windows to my soul. 3 years now that I've been away. A little fish had to find a bigger bowl when I touched down on the runway. Gonna run straight to my mom waiting at the gate. Get the duty free for the old man. Drink it with him till I can't stand. Never been so lonely. But when I get home, gonna hit up all the homies. Then we'll get stoned. See my nana and my grandpa. These days only see him on the laptop. These days I ain't got a day to have off. Been away so long. When I get back, I'ma hit back at the app on Dale. That's home. Never turn my back on. Where I'm from, when I'm back, then it's back on.
I heard about your most recent record on a message board on the internet, which actually still exists. And the post was like, you wouldn't believe it. If I said that this was a jazz rap record from New Zealand that is really good, you might not think that that makes any sense. And I thank goodness that they put it in that context. Because if they had just said, this is a great jazz rap record from New Zealand, I would have been like, okay, fine, whatever. Enjoy remaking Guru's Jazzmatazz or whatever for with different local references. But when I listened to it, what I thought was it is so hard to combine the aesthetics of jazz and hip hop. And usually when someone says jazz hip hop, what they mean is they are pulling a sample from a jazz record, like, you know, a sort of soul jazz record like Lou Donaldson or something like that. Just pulling four bars from it and looping them up and adding a little bit harder drums. Like they're using it the same way that they would use the same way that they would use a sample from a Journey record. You know what I mean?
Straight up.
And the aesthetic, you know, it sounds different.
And most journalists would probably still go, oh, it's got jazzy undertones if it was a Journey record, you know?
I think that your record is much more a jazz record than most records that are called jazz rap records. And I wonder if that was intentional and why you made that choice.
Yeah, I think I was well aware of everything you just mentioned. And the jazz I was listening to was jazz, so I wanted to make that. I wanted to make it sound like Ferris Sanders, not like Guru. I wanted it to have the musicianship of a jazz record, of a Blue Note record, or of a Strata East record. And so that's how I set out to do it. And then it was inevitable that people were going to call it jazz rap because it had jazz and rap in it. And I just love jazz music and I wanted to try to add something to that legacy. And it's really hard to do because it's not mine to take. And it's, I just went to a jazz gig on Monday, an amazing gig, but no one was dancing. No one was dancing, maybe because it was in 5/7 or something, I don't know, but it still seemed a bit backwards, like where jazz is these days and what it means. It's kind of sad, like it's gentrified, you know? Like, it's like this, like, wanky intellectual music that it doesn't have to be. Like, so it's such a dangerous weapon to play with. But yeah, that's what it was. And there's just so much you can do with it. It's just, I feel like I could make another 7 albums with this formula and they'd all be different. So, yeah, I just want to honor all the greats that taught me the things I understand about this music and hopefully not on what it is.
Are you an instrumentalist?
No, far from it.
So how do you make a record like this?
Just you're kind of forced to, I guess. Yeah. A lot of the time when I try to explain how the record was made, it feels like I'm saying that I was kind of forced to do it because I don't really know much about mixing or engineering or anything. I just know what chords speak to me. And so I would just find those chords through samples and things like that. And then I'd just try to make them more interesting by getting friends I knew to add to them, whether it was Julian Dine on drums or Jonathan Crayford on keys or Guy Harrison, all these people that I was lucky enough to know. I just got them to add to it. And then accidentally through that, I guess I was kind of a producer. But I had a lot of friends that helped me as well. I accidentally became some sort of producer, I guess. Producer. I'm a producer. I produce things, innit? And yeah, that's what it is, I guess. But I think rappers probably a lot of the time get undervalued as producers. Like, it's often probably assumed that the rapper had nothing to do with how the record sounds, you know? And I think that's probably wrong a lot of the time. Yeah, so maybe that will be a nice myth to bust. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Kanye West could sit down at a piano and play The Entertainer. But like, you know, Kanye West is a guy who came from sample based production, you know, like certainly Kanye West knows his way around an MPC, a sampler. But I don't think he likely even puts hands on the MPC much anymore. What he is doing is, but at the same time, I don't think his music is any less his for it. Like, I don't think there's any doubt that whether there's a guitarist in there or a guy who brought a stack of records or whatever, it is all coming from the producer on those records, and the producer is Kanye West. And I would say the same even of, you know, I'm sure it's the same for Kendrick Lamar, a guy who's probably never made a beat in his life.
That definitely
it's clear that someone is in charge of those records or they would all sound different.
Yeah. And maybe there's not a particular title that you can give, because we always want to give that title, like, oh, he's not just a rapper, he's a rapper slash producer slash, you know. But maybe it's a bit more complicated, and those titles are an easy way for us to sort of put things in the boxes. Like, you know, people often, when you know, they want to call a rapper a poet, but, you know, sometimes a rapper is just a rapper who's poetic.
I get really mad when people call rappers poets.
Yeah, you know?
I'm like, you know what? Rappers are bad poets, but you know what? Poets are bad rappers.
Yeah, straight up. That's why we try to avoid calling people rappers in the first place, because no one wants to own it. Like, you know, everyone wants to try to pretend they're something bigger than that, but in doing so, you lose all the best ones, because the best ones don't want to admit that they are rappers. And so now we're calling them all poets. Like, yeah, it's kind of dangerous. I like to own the genre of hip hop and claim it, because yeah, it's an intricate genre, and there's so much more to it than the box that people want to put all the rappers in.
More with Tom Scott from Avondale Bowling Club when we come back from a break. Ahead, this record took Tom years to make. He says he lost $10,000 in making it. I'll ask him if it changed anything about him. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor REI Co-op. We all have wild ideas, but rarely do we get to see our wildest ideas come to life. Started by adventure journalist Shelby Stanger and brought to you by REI, Wild Ideas Worth Living is a podcast that explores everything from mindfulness in school to adventures in space, overcoming fear and learning how to unplug. Ideas that started big and wild and and never stopped growing. Learn more or listen now. Search for Wild Ideas Worth Living.
Hi, it's Ali Kokesh, one of the cast members of Mission to Zix, a new addition to the Max Fun Network. We're blown away by the welcome we've received from Max Fun listeners, telling us you've discovered the show and are binging it hard, supporting us during the drive, and just being rad humans all around. Mission to Zix is an improvised, obsessively sound-designed sci-fi comedy epic
following a group of ambassadors as they explore the ass end of space. I play Dar, the 12-foot-tall omnisexual security officer with furry scales, chest talons, and a series of flaps and chutes that are for... Yeah, you know what? You'll figure it out. We'd be delighted if you joined our crew aboard the aging sentient starship, the Bargerian Jade, as we travel the Zix Quadrant, meeting all sorts of weird aliens played by brilliant guest comedians. That's Mission to Zix, ZYXX.
America has a long history of white nationalism, and its influence reaches farther than you might think.
You can go back and you can read the New York Times coverage. You can read Hitler saying, "It was America who taught us we should not open our arms equally to other nations."
This week on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us, I'm talking to Tom Scott. He's a rapper based in New Zealand. He's been making records for about 10 years. A few months back, he released a really beautiful album under the name Avondale Bowling Club, one of my favorites from last year. Let's get back into the interview. Let's hear some of Years Gone By, which is the opening track of the self-titled album from my guest Tom Scott, Avondale Bowling Club.
I cut another tree down to pass the time while I watch a lifetime pass me by. Looking back on old days, glossy eyes. Watching years go like my auntie's mom. We used to sit up in the car park and rhyme. Now a night like that is hard to find. Looking back on old times, I can't rewind. Talking to my old friends, they aren't alive no more, the years gone by.
This song was a single. It's also like 5 or 7 minutes long. And it's basically your entire autobiography. It's the story of your life, more or less, year by year. Was that a hard thing or an easy thing to write?
I guess it was both, because it's cathartic, but I also had to be quite specific. And to be honest, I probably don't remember most of my life, but maybe that was just me, like, putting together a little bunch of stuff to identify with, because I have no memory. Maybe I smoked it away, I don't know, but I really don't remember most of my life. Most times people tell me things, I'm like, true, I did that, that's interesting. So maybe that's why I wrote that. But yeah, it was hard to sum up a whole year in 2 bars or sometimes 4. But it's probably easier than writing a whole autobiography. Like, you know. At least it ends in 7 minutes. But yeah, I think it is. I think there's something interesting about trying to recall your whole life, because, you know, every time you bring a memory up, you taint it, right, with where you are remembering it. So it's really hard to know what really happened in your life. And how much weight you should place on each moment. I think that causes a lot of mental health issues, you know, like how much we think our parents weren't there for us, or, you know what I mean? Cause you really can't, even the trauma, you only remember a couple days of it. And how important was that compared to the other years where everything wasn't traumatic? I think those were some of the difficulties in writing that song, just making sure not to accidentally disrupt my whole reality, you know, by conjuring up these memories and giving them too much power. Yeah.
I mean, the whole album is kind of elegiac. It's about what is irrevocably gone. Like, it's about the past and memory, but like, it's in a particular way, it's not so much about living in that as just that will never be again because it's past.
Yeah. Interesting, eh? And then sometimes it's just dangerous to think that we can ever recall it, you know? Like, because it is gone. It's totally gone. And it's like trying to paint a car that just went past, you know? Like, you'll do your best impression. You know how things don't even hold up in court, like testimony from witnesses and things, you know? And how much that is disproof against memory being, you know, like how fallible memory is. I'm quite obsessed with that and interested in that idea. So, yeah, I don't know how much weight you should put into memory. But I'm guilty of reminiscing, for sure.
Both memory and hip-hop, and especially on this record, are like, in a way, acts of editing. You know, like, creating music from other music is about capturing these, like, little fleeting moments. I mean, there's hip-hop that recreates old music substantially. You know, that was the golden age of Puff Daddy solo singles. He was practically rapping over disco instrumentals. But mostly it's about capturing these little pieces as they, like, grabbing them as they float by and saying, like, you know, what if we built the whole airplane out of the black box? And I feel like memory is the same thing, like, and this song is the same thing. Like, it's you just picking the little pieces, because there's no way to fit your life into a song. But it's just these little things that stick out. You know, your MC Hammer tape and track number 9 on All Eyes on Me.
And those may be the things that you're built upon, eh? But then I think that's also what I'm saying, is that I want to remember more. I want to remember that there was a lot more. But I guess after a while you can't, or maybe you just can't access it.
I want to ask you about a few of the things that you rap about in Years Gone By, the autobiographical track on this record. When you were a kid, you say in 92, my drunk dad jumped ship on my mom. How old were you?
I think I was about, 92, 6, 8. Yeah, I was 8. I think it's a bit rough that I said that. In saying that line, I was like, it wasn't totally my dad's fault, but it kind of was. He was seeing another lady. My mum went to, he's a bass player. So one day my mum decided to go to check one of the, he's like, you know, I got a gig tonight, I'll see you later, And I guess my mom's intuition was like, I'll go see what he's up to. And she went along and saw that he was with another girl. Anyway, they broke up. But I remember the day my mom told me, like, me and your dad aren't going to be living in the same house anymore. And all I said was, all right, that's cool. Can I go outside and play basketball now? And maybe that's when I started repressing it. I don't know. But it didn't really affect me that hard. But yeah, that's what happened. I mean, yeah, and then my mom sort of raised me, and my dad, in my head, kind of wasn't there, but I'm scared that I'm, like, giving him, I'm just putting all the blame on him, to be honest. But I better be paying you $450 an hour now that I'm confessing all this.
Well, you go to a really premium therapist.
that's my story, and that's probably most people's story of my generation. Like, how many marriages work out?
The line that comes after that line about your dad jumping ship on your mom, or the two lines that come after are, in 93, I won my first fight like a D-O-double-G, and obviously that was the year that Snoop Dogg came out.
Yeah.
Still mad at the man I wanted to be.
Yeah. I think at the time I had no connection of those two events, right? But there was some stage where my mom told me that year I was really disruptive in class. I don't know if it was because I just learned how to say no and how to rebel, or if I was mad at the man I wanted to be. And I think I kind of was. I think I was a little bit gutted about it. And you know what? Unrightfully so. I don't think I had a right to be, because he tried to do what he could. And now I find myself in his shoes raising my kid. And it's hard, man. It's hard to have time for your child and your partner. One thing I've been, cheesy metaphor that I've been talking on, but lately is like, if you want to feed a plant, you water the roots. And I think like we forget to do that when we have children. We forget to water the relationship, like put time into the relationship. Because if you do that, your kid's going to be good. But anyway, I don't think my dad and my mom really did that. And yeah, I guess it kind of upset me, but I just feel like such a brat being upset by that. You know, it's the kind of thing you should just deal with, you know? It's not your problem.
Number one, I don't think that's true. The not your problem part. But number two, I feel like one of the things that I have learned as an adult, and especially from actual therapy, was that it was okay for me to simultaneously believe that things about my childhood caused me emotional problems that I still grapple with to this day. But that did not mean that my parents weren't and aren't good people who are doing their best.
Yeah. I think, you know, they're just kids, man. They're just trying. Like, maybe it's a dangerous thing to put as much weight as we do on the definition of a parent. You know what I mean? Like, there's a Tupac song that says, "Mama's just a little girl." And just, that sums it up in that line right there. You know, they were just trying. They didn't know what they were doing. So, yeah. But yeah, it's not to say that your pain isn't real. I just think there's a lot more to be sad about in the world than that.
In this song, Years Gone By, you rap a little bit about the mid-aughts. Mm. And it sounds like in the early years of the 21st century, you really got lost.
Yeah, I did. Didn't know I was lost, though, like anyone who's lost. But looking back at it, I realized I definitely was. I dropped out of school. School didn't do it for me. I don't know where that started, but at some point I was more concerned with Nas than Shakespeare. And I didn't relate to what the school system was trying to give me. Maybe that's my excuse for my bad attention span. I don't know. Whatever it was. I went to a public school. Not trying to blame it on that either. But I dropped out of school, and then I worked all these jobs, like cleaning hotel beds. That's why I just left a tip at the hotel I'm in, because I know how painful that is. Packing rice in a factory, digging holes for the council, everything. My mama was like, "You go pay the rent," you know? Yeah, to be honest, all those jobs showed me, like, they taught me more than anything I ever learned, like the value of a dollar and all of that. Anyway, I got lost somewhere in there because I think it was hard. And in New Zealand, in the working class, we work and then we drink. That's what we do. On a Friday night, the liquor store has a line out the door, you know? You work and you drink. And in the process of that, I got a bit lost. And I fell out with my best friend one night. We got way too drunk and we got in a fight. And just everything was going wrong. I was with this girl. She left because I was a piece of shit. And and I kept doing my music. And I guess music eventually was the remedy that I needed. But it was a hard time, I guess, looking back. Plus, you're too young to know what's going on, you know, thrown out of the house, sort of figuring it all out. Is that a universal kind of feeling?
I got thrown out of the house, too.
Yeah, right.
I'm a committed rule follower, which is why I work in public radio. But it's terrifying.
Yeah. It was, eh? I mean, it's part of the right? It's like rite of passage, crippling depression.
You have a line in the song where you say, "Then 06, my homie hung in the park where we all hung."
Yeah. Yeah. We used to drink in this park in Morningside. All of us, you know, first time we started smoking, you know, we're smoking mad weed just every day, all day, getting into trouble. We're all best friends, you know? And one of my bros, he started getting into, like, he was smoking meth and stealing cars and all sorts of shit. And one night he crashed this car and he came around to the bro's house and the bro wasn't there and he left. And I think that night he hung himself in that park where we used to drink. And that f***ed me up. And yeah, because in New Zealand, a lot of us do it. A lot of us young men do that. I don't know what you guys know about this country, but we're a colonized country, you know. I'm someone with the same skin as the colonizers. But they brought with them, you know, Catholicism and sort of hushed out the native people's culture and beliefs, a tribal people who would speak about their problems and, you know, brought with it this sort of harden up attitude, you know. We thrive at rugby, a sport that's just played by macho dungies, to be honest. And that's our attitude on things here, harden up, you know. That's something you'll constantly hear people say here, harden up. And there was a thing where you weren't even allowed to talk about suicide on the radio because they thought that sort of led people to do it. Like, we don't know what the we're doing with this problem. We got some ideas, but we really haven't solved it. We got the highest rate of youth suicide in the world, and we got it good. We're supposed to be, you know, clean, green New Zealand. But yeah, so everyone in this country probably knows someone who took their life. And for me, that changed everything for me, that day when I found out that my bro had taken hers. After that, I just swore that I'd never let my masculinity get in the way of, like, my emotions ever again, you know. And I'm a tough kid myself, you know. I'm from a place where you had to know how to fight and you had to, like, you had to be hard, you know. But I'm over that. It's not worth it. I said, you know, like, the amount of times you could be wrong by being positive, I think, outweigh the amount of times you could be wrong being negative, you know. What if you're wrong about your self-worth, you know?
There's a beautiful song on the record called Friends with the R in parentheses, so it also spells fiends.
Yeah.
Old boy sitting in the dark with a light bulb and a lighter in the sand like a pyro. Just can't put the thing down like an iPhone. Got too high, flipped out like a psycho. What's he gonna do? Where's he gonna go now? Last I heard, he was living in a motel. Broke up with his old girl, then he broke down. Took it out on the best bro, they ain't bros now. What you really know about spot like that? 31 years old, addicted to crack since way back. How you gonna quit like that? Try kick that shack, it'll kick right back. Move back.
There are a lot of hip-hop records about drug addiction, and they come mostly from two perspectives, or have mostly come from two perspectives. One is, I do this all the time, this isn't a problem. Mm. And one is, you know, kind of a classic, yeah, crackheads are funny and pathetic. And I mean, I don't mean to say that that's every hip-hop song about drug addiction, but that's a lot of them. And
yeah. I think Nas is definitely... let's make sure that we're not the white guys that say all of African-American music is about drug dealers.
No, not at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Not at all. But, you know...
We're definitely not saying that. Eh?
Even Nas was laughing at bass heads.
Yeah, true. Selling some stolen amps.
Yeah.
Broken amps?
Broken amps, yeah.
Nah, you're right.
And Friends is a song that is, like, deeply sympathetic to people who are deep in drug addiction.
Yeah. I think the reason being is that my parents were both fiends. My dad still struggles with addiction. They both come from the love movement, which, you know, nothing feels more like love than opiates, you know. So I know how to empathize with a fiend. And That's really the only way to fix it. Like, you know, these people need help. And we could go a bit deeper into, like, how many people need help, because, yeah, I just kind of also believe that if you grew the weed, it's you know, it's on you to remove it as a society. It's like, that came from something. So, yeah, our addiction problems in New Zealand come from probably our toxic masculinity, you know, our refusal to acknowledge colonialism, da 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 da. There's a whole lot to it. And I think we got to start by empathizing these people that are victims of this system. My old man now, he works in a needle clinic where they provide, like, services for people that are addicted to certain substances. And he gets in trouble from the management because he's too empathetic to these people. They're like, you can't get attached to these people. They're bloody fiends, you know. And it's a weird way of looking at things, man. It's weird. I don't get it.
Did spending all this time on this record, and you worked on this record for years, and making a record that is so much a kind of record of your life, no pun intended, did it change the way you think about yourself?
I think so, because I now get to reflect on everything. It's like the timer went off. Deed, what do you think of yourself? Okay, that's all the time we have. What do you think of yourself now? So, yeah, I think it definitely did. It was a checkpoint, like I was saying. I think it helped me. I think it really did help. Eh? Like, now that you asked that, no one's ever really asked that. But, yeah, it helps you see yourself and see where you're at and where you're going. Yeah, and I now see I can see myself as a father. I can see myself a little bit as a role model and understand what I got to do from here. It changed the way I see myself, I think. I don't really like seeing myself. It's frightening. But yeah, it did.
Tom, I really appreciate you taking all this time to be on Bullseye. It was really great to talk to you.
Bruv, I appreciate you taking all this time, man. Thank you so much, brother. Thank you.
Tom Scott. Avondale Bowling Club is the name of this project and the record that he dropped last year. It's really special. Let's go out on one more song from the album. This is called Quincy's March.
Found hope in the mundane, I felt deep in the well-known. Train clack in the background like Coltrane on the Alto. From Friday in the K-hole to Saturday at Kmart. Old days in the haze, my heydays in the hay barn. I lay under the radar in the backyard, at peace, now at last. Maybe all of this happiness, it ain't as hard as I act. Can't really complain about nada. Holy mother marijuana, it's kind of craziness making atheists start to think about karma. Start to see the chink of my armor, start to see myself in my father.
We've come to the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is recorded at MaximumFun.org world headquarters, overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California, where this week they were shooting a huge prestige cable television drama. And we got to see not only a giant helicopter landing platform, but America's hyphiest football running back. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. Jesus Ambrosio is our associate producer. We got help from Casey O'Brien. Our production fellow is Jordan Cowling. Our interstitial music is by DJW, the great Dan Wally. Our thanks to him for giving us that music. Our theme song is called Huddle Formation. It's by the band The Go Team. Thanks to them and their label Memphis Industries for letting us use it. And before you go, I've been making this show for almost 2 decades. That means literally hundreds of interviews, and you can check them all out on our website at MaximumFun.org. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. You can hear lots of episodes on those platforms as well. And I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from Schwab. With Schwab investing themes, it's easy to invest in ideas you believe in, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, and more. Schwab's research uncovers emerging trends, then their technology curates relevant stocks into over 40 themes to choose from. Schwab Investing Themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Visit schwab.com/thematic investing.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
It's a high-stakes election year, so it's not enough to just follow along. You need to understand what's happening so you are fully informed come November. Every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast, our political reporters break down important stories and backstories from the campaign trail so you understand why it matters to you. Listen to the NPR Politics Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.